This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we'll hear about how the Afghanistan war has perhaps more to do about energy than terrorism.
It's a high-stakes chess game, with the U.S. on one side, Russia and China on the other. They're all fighting for the same thing, oil in Central Asia.
Are animal rights activists terrorists? The FBI seems to think so, as it's labeled them one of the top domestic terrorist threats in this country. We'll hear excerpts from a panel held at the 2009 Animal Rights Conference in Los Angeles last month.
If you want to talk about overreaching, it's overreaching by calling those who want to protect animals terrorists.
Stay with us. Is the Afghanistan war less over terrorism than it is over energy? It's a high-stakes chess game, writes Con Hallinan, a foreign policy analyst. And if the U.S. controls the sources of energy of its rivals, Europe, Japan, and China, as well as other nations, they win. Hallinan says strategic energy alliances are forming between Russia and China. China is planning a 4,000-mile pipeline from the Caspian Basin to the Guangdong province. While Russia is locking up natural resources, such as natural gas, in Central Asia. Con Hallinan joins us today. A lecturer in journalism at the University of California, Santa Cruz, he is also a contributor to Foreign Policy in Focus.
Con Hallinan, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thanks for having me.
We were most impressed with an article that you've recently written called Blood and Oil in Central Asia, because it gives an overall view of long-range American policy and kind of gives an understanding to people about why they're fighting this war in far-off Afghanistan and far-off Pakistan. Could you give our listeners a little background on what your take is on that question?
Well, I think if you kind of stand back and look at the big picture, what this is about is it's about the United States attempting to control energy resources at a time when world oil reserves are beginning to drop. And in fact, there's going to be a pretty sharp drop in world oil reserves. And so Michael Clare, who writes for The Nation and also for Foreign Policy in Focus, has a new study out which indicates that this we've kind of reached that point now. We've reached the tipping point where oil resources are and gas resources are going down at the same time as there are at least three major economies, Brazil, India, and China, in which you have this tremendous development in these economies. And so there is this very sharp, growing sharp competition for controlling those energy resources. And there's only a limited number of places that they are. The United States pretty much has its thumb on the Middle East oil reserves, with the exception of Iran. And it's now attempting to maneuver, and has been really since the Clinton administration, to maneuver to control the resources of gas and oil coming out of the Caspian Basin. So if you take a look at the war in Iraq and the war in Afghanistan, the current war in Pakistan, they sort of follow what Pepe Escobar from the Asia Times calls the roadways of Pipelandistan. And it's a great term. It's trying to look at oil and natural gas resources as if you're looking at a map. And let's follow the pipelines. And they always tell us in investigative journalism, you know, you'll follow the money. Well, follow the pipelines. If you follow the pipelines, then you can see why it is that the U.S. is in the Balkans, where there's a very large pipeline, the Albanian, Macedonian, Bulgarian corporations pipeline that takes Caspian Basin oil to the west and bypassing Iran and Russia. And all of the pipelines that come down out of the Caspian and which we want to build desperately. So what you really have here is that you have a struggle not so much just around oil and gas or for private corporations. What you have is a battle for the control of energy resources. And whoever wins that battle, whoever holds the high ground over the next half century, is really going to be able to have their hand on the jugular vein of their potential competitors. In our case, that involves India, China, and particularly China, of course, and to a certain extent, Japan.
Now, mentioning China, in your article, you say that there's a new strategic alliance between Russia and China, and that combined with the expanding of NATO, two seemingly unrelated events have turned Central Asia into this focus.
One of the things that happened when Gorbachev sat down and talked about essentially dismantling the Soviet Empire in Eastern Europe, there was an agreement. The agreement was that the North Atlantic Treaty Organization would not expand into previous Soviet republics or countries that border the Soviet Union. And of course, we broke that agreement immediately. The Clinton administration was particularly responsible for that. What's happened is that former Warsaw Pact allies, Romania, Bulgaria, Poland, Czech Republic, all of those were pulled into NATO, along with Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania. The Ukraine and Georgia are currently up for membership. And so what you've seen is this tremendous expansion of NATO, not only into former Soviet areas, but also into Central Asia. With the expansion of NATO there, what's happened is this kind of counter-response. Economically, it's something called the Shanghai Cooperation Organization. And the Shanghai Cooperation Organization includes Russia and China and Kyrgyzstan, Uzbekistan, Kazakhstan, and Tajikistan, with observer status from Iran, Pakistan, and India. I mean, what we're talking about here is a stunningly large body of people. It represents about 60% of the world's gross national product and about 75% of the world's energy resources, and also about 75% of the global population. So the result of NATO sort of muscling in to former Soviet Union and to Central Asia is that there has been this counter response, mainly on the part of Russia and China, but involving all of the major countries in the region. And that's where the competition is, and it's between those two blocks there. And at this point, the Shanghai Cooperation Organization is kind of on a roll.
What is the Collective Security Treaty Organization, and how does that fit in?
Well, it's really a military organization. It's the equivalent of NATO, and it includes everybody who's in the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, with the addition of Belarus and Armenia. And it is a real formal military organization. Each of those countries contributes a battalion of troops. The Collective Security Treaty Organization is currently setting up a rapid reaction force, the mainly Russian airborne divisions and air assault brigades. And basically what they're there to do is to counter NATO. And they're not only countering it by building up a separate military force, but then they're also setting up agreements. For instance, China has recently opened up the aid spigot to Central Asia. And China is weathering the current economic situation not badly. Their growth rate now is up a little over 8% because they have such a huge domestic market. So they can fall back on a domestic market. They're not entirely reliant on export money. And they've been pouring, they loaned Turkmenistan $3 billion in June. They're developing Turkmenistan's Yoltan-Osman gas field. And one of the things that they're doing is that they're making these loans, and there's a condition. And the condition is that these countries will not allow, quote, third parties into the region. Well, the only third party in Central Asia is NATO. So you have this vast chess game going on. I mean, it's really the kind of 21st century version of the great game, the 19th century great game. And you have all these chess pieces moving about on the board, and pipelines, their military organizations, their political organizations, et cetera. And they're all maneuvering around the same thing, which is who controls the energy resources coming out of Central Asia. Now, I don't want to just limit it to Central Asia, because I think you also have to take a look at what's happening with Brazil and the development of the Brazilian oil and gas fields off the coast, 100 miles out at sea. And, of course, Venezuela and the Orinoco Basin, which is one of the great oil reserves on the planet, may be the biggest oil reserves on the planet. We're not absolutely certain.
Con Allen, let me ask you about the Obama administration, because there was so much hope when the Democrats took office in the White House last January. And it seems to me that, more and more the bloom is coming off the rose, and there seems to be more evidence and more of a realization that there's continuity between that administration and the Bush administration, which was nakedly an oil administration with Cheney at its head. What's your take on the Obama administration? Do they have a long-run view, as Cheney and Bush had, in terms of Afghanistan and its resources and, the resources of the oil-rich countries in that area?
Well, I think they do. You know, I think that and this is not to say that I don't think there's a difference between Obama and Bush. I think there is a difference between the two of them. But, you know, we're talking about empire here. And I think whoever is in power in this country is going to address the situation that the United States economically is falling behind. Politically, it has been very isolated. And it still wants to be the big dog on the block. And to do that, it means it's got to control energy resources. And it also has to prevent the development of other competition. Now, this is, you know, all of the sanctions directed at Iran and all that kind of stuff, is Iran is a real potential competitor. And if they can basically isolate Iran, if they can manage to get oil and gas out of the Central Asia or the Middle East without going through Iran, then that puts Iran in a difficult situation. China and Iran has a very close relationship. So if you sanction Iran, you indirectly, you end up sanctioning China. Same thing for Russia. So I think that you're correct in saying that the long-term goals are really not any different. I must admit, and I maybe, you know, I had some of that bloom too, because 8 years of Bush will, you know, put you in the mood for faith-based initiatives, is basically what I was feeling. But I think that, you know, the current situation in Afghanistan and Pakistan, is the U.S. is just doing every single thing wrong that it could possibly do. And I don't know. I somehow want to go to the White House, and I want to sit down with Obama, and I say, okay, look, just read Kipling. Just sit down and read Kim. You know, read the poem Arithmetic on the Frontier. Just read those things and recognize this is just an absolute disaster. And it's not just that the war in Afghanistan is a disaster, but we're destabilizing the entire region. The situation in Pakistan, you have to be a little careful. There's a lot of hype here. Taliban are going to take over in Pakistan. Taliban are not going to take over in Pakistan. It's nonsense. However, we are destabilizing the relationship between Pakistan and India, and that's an extremely dangerous flashpoint. The most single dangerous flashpoint in the world right now is Kashmir. We have two nuclear-armed powers that came very, very close to a nuclear war in 1999. I mean, really close, to the point that the Pakistanis took their warheads out of storage and started to think about loading them onto missiles. So I wish that there was a brand new approach here. I do think that there are differences, but ultimately this is about empire, and I don't think that one person can come in and change that, and I don't know if he wants to change it.
Yeah, Con, I really, this is Michael Ratner, and I really appreciate this entire talk with you and your article. I just think it gives people some perspective that this isn't just about 9/11 and the Taliban and Al-Qaeda. This is about a much deeper issue, as you said, about empire.
Do you have a website that we can share with our listeners, Con?
If you go to foreignpolicyinfocus.org, which is who I generally write for, and that's part of the Institute for Policy Study. But it turns out I'm also the only Con Hallinan in the world. If you put quote marks around Con, and remember that Con is two N's, C-O-N-N, all you get is me. So apparently I have a completely unique name. If you don't put quote marks around it, then you get a lot of stuff from the Connecticut Tourist. hero.
Well, I can appreciate that, having the most common first and last name in America.
Yes.
So this is Michael Smith on behalf of Heidi Bogosian and Michael Ratner, thanking you, Con Hallahan, for
you,
being
Con.
On Law and Disorder.
Thank you.
Well, it was a pleasure being on, and thanks for having me.
Oh, take it easy.
Bye-bye.
Okay.
Now we'll hear from our own Heidi Bogosian. Why is the government exaggerating the so-called threats from animal activists while it's failing in its claimed campaign to stop domestic terrorism?
Help me welcome Heidi Bogosian.
Good evening, everyone. Briefly, I'd like to tell you a bit about the National Lawyers Guild. We've been around for over 70 years, 40 of which has been spent in large part defending protesters. We go to demonstrations around the country and provide what we call trained legal observers to watch police in constitutional infractions and to document trends. And we've seen a number of disturbing trends over the last decade. But I think we need to look first at the events of 9/11 and the Bush administration's response to put into perspective some of what we're seeing today vis-a-vis the treatment of animal rights activists. As you know, the Bush administration launched essentially a preemptive model of intelligence gathering in its so-called war on terrorism. A war that has failed abysmally and devastated both specific communities and civil liberties across the board. The bipartisan 9/11 Commission issued failing grades to the administration in how it implemented or failed to implement the Commission's recommendations for reform. It gave 5 F's, 12 D's, 8 C's, and several incompletes. Notably, an F for failure to develop standards to detain and prosecute terrorism. After 9/11, the government spent enormous resources. It fingerprinted and registered 80,000 Arabs and Muslims. It interviewed 8,000 immigrants. It imprisoned 5,000 foreign nationals in preventive detention. Of this total of 93,000 individuals who were submitted to aggressive tactics, not one has yet been convicted on terrorism charges. Enter the animal rights and environmental activist movements. The FBI, as you know, calls them both the top domestic terrorism threats. And they have provided easy victories for an incompetent government to claim as one of its few successes in its so-called war on terror. And the government, as Odette mentioned, had willing allies in multinational corporations. Since 9/11, George W. Bush has told his audiences that Americans refuse to live in fear. And yet he himself and the administration have just done the very same thing. They have exploited fear to justify the vilification of activists and to create domestic terrorism laws for what the FBI calls extremists. Over the past decade, the National Lawyers Guild has seen activists punished and free speech criminalized by negative media depictions, calling them violent anarchists, especially before large demonstrations such as the Republican and the Democratic National Conventions. We've seen what has become the normalization of the use of less lethal munitions on passive crowds. We've seen mass arrests of innocent individuals merely to get them off the streets in the presence of the mainstream media. Grand jury subpoenas to intimidate activists, turn others against each other in a climate of mistrust. FBI infiltration of activist groups, creation of databases, the use of the charge of conspiracy to affect prosecutions, passage of ADA and local domestic terrorism laws based on a template provided by corporations. We've seen police committing perjury about the treatment of activists and then altering videotapes in New York City that would exonerate innocent protesters. We've seen pretextual searches of organizing spaces on such pretexts as fire code violations, which is unlawful to do. We've seen the creation of free speech zones to keep protesters' messages out of the public eye, unprecedented and unconstitutional bails for perceived leaders, and most seriously, as we're here to discuss tonight, the labeling of domestic terrorism to ruin lives and to try to stop social activism. The animal enterprise has instilled fear because it is vaguely written. It is impossible to know what speech will be prosecuted, although tonight we're beginning to get a sense, as you'll hear. This has resulted in what we call a chilling effect on First Amendment activities, which is just as bad as stopping it in its tracks. The government's deference to corporations has resulted in the Animal Enterprise Terrorism Act, but it also affects activism in other ways. Just this week, the mayor of St. Petersburg unveiled a $700,000 security plan to turn over public sidewalks to big business. The owners wanted to keep, as they said, loiterers and protesters off the sidewalks. And just as other large cities do on a regular basis, the Pittsburgh police and the federal government are already partnering with businesses to criminalize dissent at the G20 summit this September. They have already started their campaign of fear by vilifying protesters. The AP reported that violent protesters were expected to come to town. The National Lawyers Guild a few years ago started a 1-800 number. We call it the Green Scare Hotline, but it's for animal rights and other activists who've been visited or targeted by the FBI. We've also just printed a booklet that is available free of charge tomorrow. I've hidden them under Will Potter's Green is the New Red table. It's called Operation Backfire, a survival guide for environmental and animal rights activists. I brought a whole box, so I hope you'll take some back to your local groups. I just want to end by saying that the Guild and other groups and individuals, some of them here, will continue to fight such vilification and unlawful treatment of protesters by defending them and by documenting these unlawful tactics. And I want to say on a personal note that we respect the courage and commitment of you, all of you here today and the other animal rights activists, and thank you deeply for your acts of conscience. Thank you.
That was our own wonderful Heidi Boghossian.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org.
Are animal rights activists terrorists? The FBI seems to think so, as it's labeled them one of the top domestic terrorist threats in this country. We'll hear excerpts from a panel held at the 2009 Animal Rights Conference in Los Angeles last month. We now hear from attorney Matthew Struger, cooperating with the Center for Constitutional Rights, on one of the first Animal Enterprise Terrorism Act prosecutions in California.
This past Monday, attorneys Matthew Struger and Colleen Gretsch argued on behalf of the ADA 4 in Federal District Court in San Jose that ADA is unconstitutional on its face. We're very lucky to have Matthew with us this evening. Matthew, we congratulate you for taking on the constitutional argument in court and doing an excellent job. Please come up and say hello to everyone and share some of your thoughts with us.
Thank you, Odette, and everyone here. So Odette asked if I should just come up for a couple of minutes, two actually, and give just a quick overview of how the argument went and sort of some of the arguments we made in the back and forth with the government. This might be some legal mumbo-jumbo that's kind of boring, but our basic arguments were that the Animal Enterprise Terrorism Act is vague and overbroad, like folks have been saying up here tonight, and those are legal terms, but I think most folks can understand what they mean. Our first argument was that the statute is vague, and basically what that means is that by looking at the face of the statute, by reading it, it's impossible to tell what the statute covers. There's a slew of undefined terms. There's definitions against damage and economic damage and interference, and it's unclear as to what any of that means. I mean, every food choice I make every day is designed to interfere with an animal enterprise. So, I mean, that's one of our arguments. So, but when you actually do, you know, our following argument is that when you actually do figure it out, the statute goes too far. It's clearly overbroad. It criminalizes protected speech and conduct that's clearly covered by the First Amendment, and that's basically the argument. And the government got up there and they said, no, you know, there's an exception in here for boycotts. You can see right here, there's an exception for boycotts. This is only used to go after property damage and things like that. And that's total horseshit. The boycott exemption explicitly premises liability on the reaction of third parties. So if you organize a boycott and someone gets pissed off and goes out and does something like break a window, you, the organizer of the boycott, who's done absolutely nothing illegal, they can go after you under this act. And the reason they did that is because of the Shack 7, because they wanted to be able to get the people who were doing the organizing, the courageous above-ground activists, not the underground activists aren't courageous, but the people who are willing to put their neck out and put their face to it, they wanted to be able to go after those folks. And the government attorney in the Shack 7 appeal said exactly that. So the government's response was basically, well, we're not really going to address that. This case has to do with threats. And the statute is divided into a threat section and a damage section. And they basically said, you have no right to get up here and say that the damage section impinges on any First Amendment rights because that's not what these defendants are charged with. And unfortunately, the judge seemed to be leaning with them on that. And the case law is bad for us on that point. So the judge did seem like he might be inclined to go with us if he lets us make the argument, but there's lots of requirements in the federal court that close the door to people who are trying to stand up for justice for them to say, no, you're not even allowed to raise this argument in court. So should we lose? I'm not saying we will, but should we lose? We can go on with an as-applied challenge in this case, which says that the activity charged here is unconstitutional as applied to these individuals. It's unconstitutional as to chalking and chanting and leafleting. So we would still have that, and the law is very good with us on that. And then we're also trying to bring the exact same motion in this Utah case because the Utah two are charged under the damages provision. Thank you.
That was Matt Struger, cooperating attorney with the Center for Constitutional Rights. We now hear from attorney and guild member Bob Bloom, one of the defense attorneys for the Animal Enterprise Terrorism Act 4, as they're called.
Hi, thank you all for being here. It's really a delight. This all happened by accident back in 1969. I was kind of doing some all right stuff, but I got involved with the Black Panther Party, a particular case, and it changed my life in so many ways. For one thing, the truths that I learned from the people and the courage that I learned to respect really did change my life. And one of the ways that my life has been affected is I've represented a number of different kinds of activists, a Puerto Rican independence struggle, Palestinians, Judy Barry, who wasn't mentioned by name, Brianna, and now the animal rights movement. And I have to tell you that to see your faces and to see your presence and to know your courage, and yours particularly, thank you, is very inspiring to me. It really, and it's made me a better person. And I should tell you, I mentioned to Alex, that I'm close to doing vegan now, and it'll be good for me too. And one thing I always like to say at these kinds of events is, looking out here, this is a very good-looking jury panel. And I was told to start with a joke, and I'm just going to do a quick joke because I heard it the other day and it's kind of funny. What's the difference between Tiger Woods and George W. Bush? And the answer is, Tiger Woods is a great golfer and George W. Bush is a f***ing asshole. Okay, so that worked. The title of this panel is about repression. And one of the things I came to learn, particularly through particular people involved in the Black Panther Party, was how the criminal justice system, such as it's called, is a principal mechanism to control people who want to make things better and want to change things. It's essentially a very important tool of the people, used by the people who own this country. And it includes the legislators who pass the legislation. It includes the president or governors if it's state legislation. It includes the police. It includes the courts. It's really important to remember that it includes the courts and most of the judges. Every now and then, a little bit of justice comes out of the court, but not very often. And I like to say, kind of a one-liner again, when justice comes out of a court, it's kind of like a broken clock that's right twice a day. Other than that, the courts are not for justice, they're for repression. And this statute, the Animal Enterprise Terrorism Act, and before we get to terrorism, the concept of animal enterprise seems to be, it struck me in my readings in preparation for this and just in general preparation for the case, the concept that there are, the way animals are treated, it's like you can have an enterprise, a business enterprise, that uses and tortures animals. It just doesn't seem right. You know, there's a, I picked out one quote from a professor at Morehouse College, name is Charles Magle, and I'll read it, it's very brief. Ask the experimenters why they experiment on animals, and the answer is, quote, because the animals are like us. Ask the experimenters why it's morally okay to experiment on animals, and the answer is, because the animals are not like us. That's what this case is about. These four young people, Joe Buddenberg is my client, and three other really wonderful young men and women. What they did was they spoke up. They found the names, where they're accused of finding the names and addresses of animal experimenters and doing nothing more than picketing and shaming them and letting their neighbors know who their neighbors are. That's what they did. There used to be this thing called the First Amendment. Well, the government had its way. The First Amendment is out the door. And this case is so important because even for those people as to whom animal rights is not their cause, this is the first step. This is the Trojan horse in stepping on one or another social movement or geopolitical movement. That's the way. That's what they do, and that's the way they do it. The history of this statute is quite amazing. In October of 2005, nearly 4 years ago, the particular senator who introduced this, truly the worst senator of 100, his name is Imhoff, a horrible human being, he introduced it, and he introduced it at the behest of the National Association for Biomedical Research, the vivisectors. Soon thereafter, the Senator Feinstein from the state endorsed it and became a co-sponsor. Eventually, this legislation passed on voice vote in the Senate and in the House of Representatives with no dissenting voices. There may have been dissenters, but they weren't heard on the day of the vote. What do? After they talk about animal enterprise, then they talk about terrorism. And I don't have to tell you that terrorism is today's scare word. It used to be communism, that's kind of faded, but they're still relying on socialism, but terrorism is the deal. If you can call somebody a terrorist, their battle is half done, and that's why this statute has the word terrorism in it. And it's important to know that this prosecution, I think Heidi may have pointed it out, is the very first prosecution under this statute. And it's basically prosecuting picketers. That's what they did. That's what they're accused of doing. There's an FBI affidavit, and this is quite interesting. There's an FBI affidavit by the agent who's in charge of the case, and she laid out four particular incidents, and it's all about First Amendment stuff. It's all about picketing. Well, for the first time I've ever seen in 40 years, the indictment that came down doesn't have any details. It just says picketing, harassing, threatening, and so on. It doesn't lay out the details. I've never seen that in any indictment that has a conspiracy count. And I want to believe that they're just embarrassed to put it in a public indictment, that these people stood in front of people's homes and picketed and made noise and said four-letter words and wrote with chalk on the sidewalks. That's what the case is about. Congress was warned when this statute was under consideration that they were going to use it to prosecute people who were simply exercising their First Amendment rights. And sure enough, Congress didn't listen, and here it is, the very first prosecution. And that's what it's about. And it's about punishment. But in the end, the way around this is to get immense support from you all, from people you can bring in, and in the end, it's not going to be about the judge. It's not going to be about the prosecutor. It's going to be about the jury. That's why I've done this for 40 years. If there were no juries, I'd have been long gone. Judges are not there for justice. Judge White is a Republican appointee. He's been around for years. I would not count on him to do anything good. We're going to have to count on the jury. And in this particular case, the prosecutor was able to manipulate it. This case could have been brought in the Oakland division of the Northern District of California, which is where most of the accusations, most of the events took place. But they chose to do it in San Jose because they think they're going to get a more conservative jury panel. They will stop at nothing. So, do what you can. Help in any way you can. Please follow it on Portland Indie Media. Follow it on the website. And thank you for all you do. You're really courageous people. Thank you.
That was Bob Bloom. We'll now hear from award-winning writer Will Potter, who also runs the website greenisthenewred.com.
Thank you, everyone. And it's really an honor to be on this panel with a group of people that, although I hadn't met everyone in person before this, a lot of folks I'd known of and worked with for a long time over the years and been really inspired me in my work and have drawn strength from them and also inspiration. And in the case of Matthew and Heidi and soon to be Bob, pestering them constantly with legal questions and learning from their experience. My task tonight is to give a little bit of an update on the other Animal Enterprise Terrorism Act case and talk about these secretive prisons. A little bit of background on me. I've been writing about how the government's been trying to label activists as eco-terrorists since about 99 or 2000. In 2006, I testified before Congress about the Animal Enterprise Terrorism Act as the lone opposition. And in brief, the arguments I raised based on my reporting were that the Animal Enterprise Terrorism Act has a few problems, a few significant problems among many. It's vague and overly broad, and because of that, it can wrap up a broad range of constitutionally protected conduct in addition to illegal activity. And on top of that, it has a sweeping, chilling effect on people that will never even set foot in the courtroom because it's instilling a fear in a widespread group of people that they one day could be labeled a terrorist if they speak out because of their beliefs. While I was testifying, I was regularly interrupted and insulted and told that none of these concerns were valid. They said the law was narrowly constricted to underground activity. They later added a First Amendment protection exemption that Matthew explained is pretty silly to remind us, oh, don't worry, we still have a First Amendment. In addition to that, they never even adjust the chilling effect. And when they testified, I brought up a very specific example of a scenario that I thought would be a likely case of being prosecuted as First Amendment activity under the Animal Enterprise Terrorism Act. And that's nearly identical to the case of the Animal Enterprise Terrorism Act 4 out in California, the first prosecution. So members of Congress, in short, lied to me when I testified and lied to all of us about their intentions and about the scope of this legislation. So flash forward a little bit. There are these arrests in California of people that done nothing more than, at worst, using their First Amendment activity and their First Amendment rights in a controversial way of protesting outside someone's home. They're accused, among other things, of chalking defamatory slogans on the public sidewalk using children's sidewalk chalk. The second group of arrests were two individuals in Utah. And they are a little bit more in line of what members of Congress said this law is all about. William Veal, or BJ, and Alex Hall, they're both in their early 20s. They were arrested on March 5th, 2009, and accused with participating in an August 2008 Animal Liberation Front fur farm raid in Utah. The raid released about 300 mink, caused about $10,000 in damage, according to the government. At the site of the raid were a spray painting that read, "No more mink, no more murder," and "ALF, we are watching." So you might be thinking, well, what is the constitutional argument to make about that? It's clearly not First Amendment activity. And that's not my task up here tonight. I'm not arguing in any way that it's First Amendment activity. But at the end of the day, what this case, I think, illustrates perhaps most clearly of the government's continued war on the animal rights and environmental movements is the stark contrast between what is being labeled, according to the FBI, as the number one domestic terrorism threat and what most reasonable people would consider terrorism. And that's this: one is intended to destroy life and the other is intended to protect it. Together, the arrests in Utah and in California, in my mind, truly reflect both the breadth and the depth of the government's continued war on dissent. They illustrate the true motives, the scope, and the willingness and the lengths to which they're willing to go to enforce this corporate political agenda. It doesn't end there, though. The depth that we're talking about is actually quite a bit deeper than that. And we need to keep in mind through all of this that the government and corporations have tried to have a monopoly on the terrorism rhetoric in the entire cycle, or linear process, of these cases. So before activists are arrested as terrorists, as they're just going about their business, they're smeared as eco-terrorists and domestic terrorists. Their media campaigns, their sound bites, their speeches, they're routinely harassed by FBI and by law enforcement. They're harassed in the press by corporations, and that's these outlandish press campaigns calling them terrorists for trying to speak out on behalf of animals. When they are arrested, either they're hit with outright with terrorism charges, as in these cases, or after they're convicted, they're hit with terrorism enhancement penalties, as was the case in the Operation Backfire cases out in the Pacific Northwest. Then, after they're convicted, they have that terrorism label follow them throughout the rest of their criminal justice experience, let's call it that. So activists have black boxes around their wrists as they're transported between facilities. They often have orange jumpsuits to designate them as terrorist inmates, to have their privileges restricted. And what we're seeing now is a continued extension of that with what are called communication management units. There are two facilities that were opened up. In April of 2006, the Department of Justice created or proposed some new rules on how so-called suspected terrorism inmates should be treated within the United States. Civil liberties groups raised a string of objections about how they're too vague and too broad. It died down a little bit. And then a few months later, the DOJ went ahead and opened the first communication management unit anyway, bypassing the official Administrative Procedures Act and the process they're supposed to go through. A few years later, in May 2008, they opened the second facility in Marion, Illinois. Individuals have been transferred there without being notified what the designation is that's prompting their transfer, how they can appeal that designation, what it means, how they get out of it, what the appeals process is. While they are there, they're restricted in their communications with the outside world and with their supporters. Their phone calls are limited to one per week at 15 minutes. Most inmates get about 300 minutes a month. They're restricted to 4 hours of visitation per month, no contact. Even the inmates in the most restrictive facilities in the country, ADX Supermax in Florence, get multiple times that. Some of the individuals there include Raffel Dauffer. He was accused of providing and violating the economic sanctions on Iraq by sending medical supplies through charity to the children of Iraq. Daniel McGowan is part of the Earth Liberation Front arrest and Operation Backfire that never harmed anyone. Andy Stepanian, who is part of the Shack 7, who again didn't harm anyone. A common theme we see through all of these is that they are all have a vocal network of supporters. Above all else, these communication management units are political prisons. They're secretive political prisons. Now, the takeaway message, as I'm about to run out of time already, is that there's chances are none of you are going to end up in these facilities ever. I mean, if you just play your odds in the numbers here, the number of arrests within the broader animal rights and environmental movements are insignificant. Of those arrests, only two activists, animal rights and environmental activists, has ended up in these facilities. But that's not really the point. The point here, as Dan Egan at the Washington Post said when he wrote about this, is that there are facilities for so-called second-tier terrorism inmates. And the message I wanted to leave you all with, and the message to take to the broader audience and the people you, your friends and family, is this. The arguments that we have in this conference about whether property destruction is violence, how far is too far, what is an appropriate vision of animal rights versus animal welfare, those debates don't matter anymore. They don't matter to the outside world, and they don't matter to the corporations and the government that are pushing this war on terrorism and wrapping up animal rights and environmental activists as eco-terrorists. The takeaway message that is our task to bring to everyone that is not here, the rest of the animal rights and environmental movement, and everyone paying attention is this. When you have secretive facilities and you have special legislation for so-called second-tier terrorism inmates, what we need to see from governments throughout history that have gone down this path doesn't stop with them. Because when you have secret facilities and you have special legislation for second-tier terrorism inmates, you will soon enough have special legislation and secretive prison facilities for third-tier terrorism inmates and fourth-tier terrorism inmates and fifth-tier terrorism inmates until one by one, brick by brick, the barriers between what is being labeled a protester and an activist and a dissident and a terrorist have completely crumbled. That is our task here tonight, and that is the challenge I hope to work with you all together on of taking this to a broader audience. Thank you.
That was writer Will Potter. Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org.
I knew we met each other this morning for a reason. Thinking, talking, we've worked out our problems. Look like we should have better days in front. Just because we took our time to think and talk for a much better understanding.